We appreciate the presence of each one. Good to see everybody here this afternoon after that great meal that we had together. Wonderful. We appreciate it so very much. This morning I begin a lesson called Great Sins of Otherwise Good Men. And I want to continue that. I call it Great Sins because not that any sin is good because of its value, but because of its significance. And it's significant because of the nature of it, the description of it, the part it played in the development of the scheme of redemption. And so we're thinking about these individuals who in the main were very fine and commendable individuals, but who, like all of us do on occasion, lapse into something that should not have been a part of their lives at all. And I said this morning that at least by recording these kinds of infractions and still using these people in the way that God did, it's an encouragement to us. It's not to be, God doesn't want us to get discouraged by what He's told us. He wants us to be uplifted and educated and motivated to do the right thing in our lives. So this morning we talked about Noah and Lot and Job. I'll not spend nearly as much time on each one of these points, and I don't know how far we'll get this afternoon, but I want to come back and begin in 1 Samuel 3 and verse 13, where we have Eli. There's not a whole lot said about Eli, but a few things. And he's down at Shiloh, where the tabernacle of God is kept for a while. And so he's serving down there. And he's the one, you recall, in whose custody the young boy Samuel was placed. Samuel will become a great judge and the last judge in Israel. So Eli's down there serving God at the temple in Shiloh. And when Samuel is down there, having been brought there by his mother in accordance with her vow, God tells him that I'm going to do something. I've already told Eli this. But I'm going to judge his house because of the sins of his sons and his sin. Because his boys made themselves vile and he restrained them not. There's nothing else mentioned in the text with regard to the failure of Eli's character. But there doesn't have to be as far as the plan works out. But he's got these two boys and they're wicked. They're not just, you know, out of control individuals and minimally, you know, weak or sinful or whatever, and that's bad. But they're wicked and they take advantage of girls who come to the tabernacle for religious purposes. And they just have their eyes on sin. That's what they think about. Wicked people. And God says, in effect, to Samuel, the young boy Samuel, Eli knows this. He knows about his situation. And I've already told him that I'm going to punish him because of these things. The failure to control children. Now you say, well, once the child gets out from under my roof, there's only a limited amount of influence a parent can have. Well, that's correct. And in some cases of incorrigible kids, there's only a limited amount of it they can have on children while they're there. But still, as far as God's assignment to parents is, we all have the obligation, as we've been discussing in Ephesians 6 on Wednesday night, to bring up our children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. So when you know there's something very, very wrong, and it's not just a private affair in your family, Eli's boys are wicked with the girls of Israel. A matter of public information out there now. And Eli didn't do anything. He's not the only one that fails in this regard, as you well know, then or since. But he failed. And that's where our social and societal problems start. It's at the failure of the parental level. Just look at America now. And look at our young people, the way that they're being raised now. How they dress and how they talk. And the things that concern them most. And where is God in their lives? Where is God? So, Eli, otherwise good man, had a great problem with his children. He would not curtail them. And then there's Moses. Deuteronomy 34, 1 through 6, the last chapter in his life on earth, he's kept out of the land of Canaan. Numbers 20 and verse 8, and also 27, 12 through 14, we have some interesting information with regard to Moses. And his sin, as God explains it to him, seems to be that he allowed his frustration to drive him to exaltation of self. That's what it seems to me. You do your own thinking along that line. But he says to him, "Because you believe me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you're not going to go into the land of Canaan. Because you believed me not to sanctify me." See, what he just said was, "Hear ye now, you rebels, must we fetch you water out of the rock?" Now, I understand Moses' horrible treatment from the Jews. He was a much non-appreciated individual. One occasion, they wanted to kill him. And several times, he begged God's mercy upon them in spite of their faults, their continual faults, and in spite of the fact that on occasion, they treated him like dirt. And he took that for years and years. But on this occasion, when they're complaining again, they don't like the way God does things. They don't like the program. And then Moses is supposed to speak to the rock this time. This is the second time. They needed a massive amount of gallons of water for the Jews. And they always come as though it's not when can we expect the next drink. It's just always criticism. And then Moses, of course, this time strikes the rock. "But must we fetch you?" It's like, in a way, he's been downed and just beaten down so much. Now, at least this time, he lifts himself up. "I'm a part of this. Must we fetch you water? I'm going to be partly responsible for this. Because you believe me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel." It looks like in the account he allows his building frustration to lit. He wasn't appreciated. Not only did they not compliment him, he was not appreciated. Not only did they not compliment him, they criticized him. Earlier, they wanted to kill him. "I'm a part of this." Can you not see perhaps that it's not just that God wasn't set apart, but He wasn't set apart even from Moses. And God, instead of getting the glory that He deserved in this situation, Moses wanted to lift himself up. It has been said that when people do not receive a certain amount of attention that they think they deserve, they'll go and find a way to get that attention. I think there's something to that. I think we've had a problem with the preacher too in the church that way, who did not think he was getting the attention that the brotherhood ought to be given to him. So he started saying some things, and they were off the wall. And boy, he got attention. And then he went off into apostasy. But I think there's something to that. If somebody does not get the attention, he thinks down deep in his heart he deserves. He'll try to find a way to see that it comes. Maybe that's part of the problem right here. And it's a one-time thing. Later we're told nobody on the earth was more meek than Moses. And if this was the lapse right here, he was driven to it. He was just almost forced into it by people that did not appreciate him at all. And then there's David. And I want to begin this, though, in Acts 13, 22. I don't want to start in the Old Testament. I want to start in something that Paul says at Antioch of Pisidia when he goes there on the first missionary tour. And in the midst of his sermon, he says this about David, verse 22. "And when he had removed him," that is Saul, "he raised up David to be their king, to whom also he bare witness and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, who shall do all my will." What a compliment. And according to Paul, that's exactly what God had said. about David, a man. And that's the way we grew up being taught that in Bible school. David was a man after the Lord's own heart. How many times have you heard that? David was a man after the Lord's own heart. And yet we know from other passages that David fell so far. 2 Samuel 11 is one of those passages, and 2 Samuel 13:21 is another one. David practiced very little self-control. I think power can do that to a person. I think money can do that to a person. I think fame can do that to a person. You get to where you think of the world as your toy. And that I'm just, you know, in the upper echelon of the distribution of power and so on, and I control a lot of things. Yes, but sometimes people like that, sometimes they don't control themselves. And David is a classic case. He lets his lust get the upper hand with Bathsheba, and then he allows himself to kill one of his soldiers in the camouflage of war. He goes from one thing to another. And earlier, when he had been on the run from King Saul, when Saul was trying to kill him, he got some showbread and gave that to his men. He had no right to eat that, and lied about the occasion. So even though David, basically down deep, is one of these good-hearted, God-fearing, God-serving individuals, he had such capacity for lapse and extreme forms of expression of sin. And it's a good comfort to us to think, well, God wanted to use David. And yeah, Nathan told him on one occasion, he's put away your sin, but you're going to have to face consequences. The child's going to die and the sword's not going to depart from your house. You're going to have to live with this. But God lets him live. And God uses him. And evidently he dies in an old age, giving Solomon great grand advice. And he's recovered himself. And that helps my spirits. It's good for me to know that it's possible to be so high and sink so low and come back. And down deep, as God knew, his heart really was a good heart. You ever heard anybody say that? Maybe they say it about somebody you're not sure of, but you hear it sometimes. Say, well, he's got a good heart. I've heard that said. Well, he's got a good heart. Well, maybe I'm beginning to wonder because of things I've seen or things I've heard. But maybe down deep, maybe it's sort of like David. It's just down there, you know, right now it's kind of covered up. Maybe that's it sometimes. And then there's Solomon in 1 Kings 11. Basically, Solomon, you know, was the wisest man on the earth. And God used him mightily. The Israelite nation reached its zenith in influence during the days of Solomon. People came from the ends of the earth to see him, to get an audience with him, to listen to him. But in 1 Kings 11, he's old now. And he's got a lot of strange wives. That's the way the King James expresses it. I like the King James. He married a lot of strange women. I've never known anyone that didn't. But I like the King James. But really the word simply means it's one of these foreigners. It's an outsider. That's the strangeness of it. Stranger. Strangers. That's the force of it. And you see, in his business as being king and having such power throughout the world, he's framing these political marriages. That's what a lot of them were. You know, he's got 1,000 wives and concubines. 1,000? And a lot of that had to do with, you know, political connection, trying to ensure peace. They won't attack us now because we've got his daughter over here. We're going to be okay with these people. We've got his daughter over here. You see? And that's what a lot of it is. It doesn't start with love and trying to have a home and a family. But it has to do with political connection and influence in the world. And so he's got these foreign women. He brings them onto this sacred soil of Palestine. And in his older age, he starts even building for them the places that they want to use in the worship of their false gods. Incredible. After all that God had done for him and to him and with him, the wisest man on the earth. Jesus will refer to that later. You've heard of the wisdom of Solomon? Greater than Solomon is here. We've heard of the patience of Job. We've heard of the wisdom of Solomon. But in his old age, He lets these foreign women turn his mind so that the text says he did not fully serve God. It wasn't that he just forsook God altogether. He just, you know, he just lowered his concern and his commitment. He would take care of some of his obligations, but he wasn't fully committed anymore. And then he's got these foreign women, you know, and they've got all these concerns about home and their fathers and their kings and all that sort of thing. And they were brought up a certain way, and surely I can gratify their desires and, you know, have a place over here for them and one over here and one over here. We can do that. We're big enough to do that, aren't we? We might say today, aren't we loving enough to do that? Aren't we tolerant enough to do that? Are we concerned enough with our neighbor to do that? And so it wasn't in his youth and it wasn't in his middle age, but it was in his old age. He allows his heart to be taken in like that. Now, I don't know what I'm going to be like when I'm old. I hope I get to be old. At least right now I want to be old. You know, after a while you have so many aches and pains you don't even want to be old anymore. But you got good health for a while. Oh, I hope I'll make it for a long time yet. But I don't know what it's going to be like. But I didn't mention Eli. By the time he died, you know, the text says he was old and heavy. I've sometimes said, if I get to be old, I will be heavy. But that's the way he died. Broken neck. That wasn't normal. But you remember the story of that. But I don't want anyone, a grandchild, a child, any family connection, for a friend, to turn my heart in my old age away from full commitment to God. You don't either. Not right now, but you have to think about that. Yeah, but when I get old, if somebody else takes care of me and I have to live with somebody else, well, the question is, regardless how my situation changes and how my health fails, will my commitment stay strong and solid to truth and righteousness? That's the question. I think I mentioned to you one time, Mid McKnight said years and years ago that after he thought about something for a while, he said he got scared, got on his knees. Lord, don't let me get to be an old, compromising preacher. Now that can happen. I can see in a way how it happens. I know what it means to mellow, but I don't yet know, and I hope I never know, what it means to compromise. That's the deal. Don't let me become an old, compromising preacher. Solomon got to be an old, compromising king. Then quickly, we come to the New Testament, and there are three people at least I want to mention. First of all is Paul. And we think about Paul as one of these great good men of history. But he sank so low in the fact that he committed persecution. He persecuted the church. 1 Timothy 1:12-17, that's held up because he says if God can save somebody like me who butchered the church, He can save you. So that's in the Bible on purpose. My case is recorded on purpose. But he was a good man who did wrong. He thought he was doing right, but it was wrong. It was very wrong. And then later on, you know, when he wants this thorn in the flesh removed, God says, "My grace is sufficient for thee." 2 Corinthians 11:29. "So I'll glory in my weaknesses," he says. "I'll glory in my persecutions, my distresses, the things that I have to face that are difficulties and problems to me. I'll glory in them because God helps me every time get through them." And we've mentioned before, how can you have a failing program when the program itself means that when you feel the weakest, God will give you the mightiest power to overcome that moment? That's what I need is faith. It's faith in the all-sufficiency of the power of God to save me and gently get me through every point in life when I feel so undone. I feel so exposed. I feel so weak before God. Paul says, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. And that's because God gave him the power. But he's one of those grand individuals who was, in the main, very faithful and strong and good and pure, but who had fallen so low in the persecution of the church. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 15:9, he would later say, "I'm not even fit to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God." And then there's Peter, the big fisherman. Peter, the man of the moment. Peter, who had usually something to say, and sometimes and quite often was wrong. A man of strong emotion and feeling of the moment. That was Peter. And Peter meant so much, and he really wanted to be so courageous. And he was. But in Luke 22:31-4, Jesus said, I made supplication for you, Peter, because the devil wanted you. And I'm telling you, you're going to have a problem, but you're going to come back. And after you've come back, I want you to help the church. And he did. That's exactly what he did. And in Galatians 2:11-12, however, years and years after years had gone by, about, I don't know, maybe in the 40s, when he's at Antioch, when he's at Jerusalem for the Jerusalem conference, they settle things there. And then Peter goes to Antioch. Now you remember the Jerusalem conference recorded in Acts 15 had to do with what the Gentiles had to do about the law of Moses. Peter was present and spoke. And he got his eyes opened as to what the real situation was. Later, he goes to Antioch, this Gentile congregation, behind the work of Saul and Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas. And he's up there. And while he's up there, he knows he has the right to eat with Gentile Christians. Now, this is a dyed-in-the-wool Jewish Christian, Peter is. Dyed-in-the-wool. But now he's in a Gentile setting, removed from Jerusalem and Judea. And he's up here, and from the day that he preached to Cornelius, and he was in Cornelius' house, and he knew that God had told him he could sit down and be with him, and he could even eat with the Gentiles. He's never had to do that in Judea. He never had an invitation in Jerusalem. There weren't any Gentiles there. But at Antioch, he has the opportunity. Years have passed. He eats with Gentiles. Feels all right about it. Paul and Barnabas are there. They all feel right about it. James, one of the pillars, the Lord's brother, who's in the church in Jerusalem, for some reason unexplained, sends some Jews from Jerusalem to Antioch. So they come up there. Peter's had to do some thinking about this, evidently. There aren't any Gentiles in Judea. This seems to be, in a way, the mother church. This is where most of the apostles still are. That's a big thing down there. And they're responsible for everybody else who has the gospel preached. It's because Jerusalem has sent out people. The brethren there scattered, you remember. Jews come to Antioch, and Peter stops eating with the Gentile brethren. Pulls himself back. I mean, you can just wonder, you know, the situation's changing. The brethren may be wondering about it. Is something, is Peter sick? Is he not feeling good? Or what is the deal up here? And the thing is, he's fearful of the Judaizers. He's fearful of the Jews who may not see it as clearly as he thinks he does, and who are not used to mixing with Gentiles themselves. There's nobody down there to do it with. And even though it's theoretically clear in his mind and he has been doing it righteously, maybe these people aren't going to think much of me if they see me doing this up here. And so, according to Paul in Galatians 2, he played the hypocrite. And he said, "I got on him." Now, Paul had been eating with Gentiles. Barnabas had. And they didn't stop when the Jews came from Judea. Peter stopped. Paul said, "I withstood him to the face." He didn't say, "Peter, here, let's go to the office. I want to talk to you about something." He'd been pulling himself back from this community of brethren. They didn't know why. I withstood him to the face. He was caught under peer pressure. And he played the hypocrite. He was afraid that the Jews from Jerusalem would not understand, take the same position, and he wouldn't do it anymore while they were there. He gets over it, evidently corrects himself, and later calls Paul beloved. Doesn't hold a grudge, and he needed the correction. But I'll tell you, brethren, that shows you the force of peer pressure in the church. I have lived to see much politics in the church. I'm sorry that it's like it. I despise it. I wish it were not like it is. And I've seen the devastation and the problems that it's still causing in congregations to this good day. And a lot of times, what happens, it's not that people hold their ground. They understand the truth and how to practice the truth. It's for fear of what he's going to say. Brother so-and-so is going to say this if I do this. Well, if I do the right thing, if I agree with this and I go along with this, I tell you what, I'm going to pay for it. Well, just do the right thing and pay for it. That's better than doing the wrong thing and paying for it. But I'm telling you, that point is of enormous worth and relevance to the church of the 21st century. And it revolves around a basically good, strong, courageous, great apostle, Peter. But because of pressure, peer pressure, he once played the hypocrite. And the final point and the final person is involved in the very same thing. Galatians chapter 2, Paul said it got so bad that even Barnabas was carried away in the hypocrisy, the dissimulation. Even Barnabas, that man that was full of the Holy Spirit, that good man, a good man, powerful man, the one that introduced Saul to the church at Antioch, the one that introduced Saul to the apostles in Jerusalem, that Spirit-filled good man. And he got caught up in it at that time. Sad, isn't it? Strange. All these points of weakness come to the surface sometimes in the development of the scheme. And as God fleshes out the full story of the cross, do you think He knows our weaknesses? Every one of them. Do you think He can still use us? Every one of us. Do you think He still loves us? All of us. Has He warned us? Each of us. He wants us to be faithful and to learn lessons from the great sins of otherwise good men. If you're here this afternoon and not a Christian, come in faith, repent of your sins, make the good confession, be baptized into Christ. If you've done that and gone astray, this is a good time to come home. Won't you do it? While together we stand, while we sing, won't you come?